Good evening, everybody. It's my pleasure and honor to welcome you all tonight to the beautiful Truman Forum Auditorium here at the Plaza Library. My name is April Roy, and it's my privilege every day to be the director of this amazing facility and library. So thank you guys for coming to my space to join us tonight for this amazing event. I would like to give a huge thank you to our partners and friends at Rainy Day Books. And now, for the main event, you guys, I'm so excited to introduce our speaker tonight. Homegoing is an amazing debut novel. It was selected for the National Book Critics Circle's John Leonard Award and the Penn Hemingway Award for Best First Book. Let's give a warm Plaza Library welcome to author Yah Jesse.
Thank you for that introduction. It's great to be here. This is my first time in Kansas City. So Homegoing is a novel that follows the family lineage of two half-sisters, Afia, the wife of the British governor of the Cape Coast Castle, is the first sister, and she lives on the upper levels of the castle. Her sister, Essie, the second half-sister, is kept in the castle as a slave before being sent to America. So the novel follows down the line, descendant after descendant, ending roughly in the present day. And I started Homegoing in 2009. I had received a fellowship from Stanford University, where I was getting my bachelor's, to travel to Ghana and conduct research for a novel. And initially, I'd had a different idea in mind. I thought that I wanted to write a novel about a mother and her daughter, and so I thought it would be nice to go to my own mother's hometown, which is in the central region of Ghana, and just see if anything struck me. While there, I ended up taking a tour of the Cape Coast Castle, and it was while on this tour that the guide started to talk to us about how the British soldiers who lived and worked in the castle used to marry the local women, which was something I had never heard before, which really fascinated me. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And so I immediately knew that I wanted to write something that would be able to kind of juxtapose those two experiences, that of somebody who would be living upstairs free and somebody who would be kept downstairs in the dungeons. But I didn't know at that point, you know, how long it would take me, how, you know, what the structure would look like, none of that. I just kind of was so fascinated by those first two characters and wanted to see where the story might go. So I'm actually going to read to you for a little bit, and I'm going to read from Ness's chapter. Ness is the first character in this novel to be born and raised on American soil. She's Essie's daughter, and we meet her when she's at a plantation in Alabama. There was no drinking gourd, no spiritual soothing enough to mend a broken spirit. Even the Northern Star was a hoax. Every day, Ness picked cotton under the punishing eye of the southern sun. She had been at Thomas Allen Stockham's Alabama plantation for 3 months. 2 weeks before, she was in Mississippi. A year before that, she was in a place she would only ever describe as hell. Though she had tried, Ness couldn't remember how old she was. Her best guess was 25, but each year since the one where she was plucked from her mother's arms had felt like 10 years. Ness's mother, Essie, had been a solemn, solid woman who was never known to tell a happy story. Even Ness's bedtime stories had been ones about what Essie used to call the big boat. Ness would fall asleep to the images of men being thrown into the Atlantic Ocean like anchors attached to nothing. No land, no people, no worth. In the big boat, Essie said, they were stacked 10 high, and when a man died on top of you, his weight would press the pile down like cooks pressing garlic. Ness's mother, called Frowny by the other slaves because she never smiled, used to tell the story of how she'd been cursed by a little dove long, long ago. Cursed and sisterless, she would mutter as she swept. When they sold Ness in 1796, Essie's lips had stood in that same thin line. Ness could remember reaching out for her mother, flailing her arms and kicking her legs, fighting against the body of the man who'd come to take her away. And still, Essie's lips had not moved. Her hands had not reached out. She stood there, solid and strong, the same as Ness had always known her to be. And though Ness had met warm slaves on other plantations, black people who smiled and hugged and told nice stories, she would always miss the gray rock of her mother's heart. She would always associate real love with a hardness of spirit. Thomas Allen Stockham was a good master, if such a thing existed. He gave them 5-minute breaks every 3 hours, and the field slaves were allowed onto the porch to receive one mason jar full of water from the house slaves. This day, in late June, Ness waited in line for water beside Tim Tam. He was a gift to the Stockham family from their neighbors, the Whitmans, and Tom Allen often liked to say that Tim Tam was the best gift he'd ever received, better even than the gray-tailed cat his brother had given him for his 5th birthday. "How your day been?" Tim Tam asked. Ness turned toward him just slightly. "Ain't all days the same?" Tim Tam laughed, a sound that rumbled like thunder built from the cloud of his gut and expelled through the sky of his mouth. "I suppose you're right," he said. Ness was not certain she would ever get used to hearing English spill out of the lips of black people. In Mississippi, Essie had spoken to her in Shwe until their master caught her. He'd given Essie 5 lashes for every Shwe word that Ness spoke, and when Ness, seeing her battered mother, had become too scared to speak, he gave Essie 5 lashes for each minute of Ness's silence. Before the lashes, her mother had called her Mame, after her own mother, but the master had whipped Essie for that too, whipped her until she cried out, "My goodness," the words escaping her without thought, no doubt picked up from the cook, who used to say it to punctuate every sentence. And because those had been the only English words to escape Essie's mouth without her struggling to find them, she believed that what she was saying must have been something divine, like the gift of her daughter. And so that goodness had turned into simply Ness. Ness was too pretty to be a field nigger. That's what Tom Allen said to her the day he'd taken her back to his plantation. He'd bought her on good faith from a friend of his in Jackson, Mississippi, who said she was one of the best field hands he'd ever seen, but to make quite sure to only use her in the field. Seeing her, light-skinned with kinked hair that raced down her back in search of her round shelf of a buttocks, Tom Allen thought his friend must have made some kind of mistake. He pulled out the little outfit he liked for his house niggers to wear, a white button-down with a boat neckline and cap sleeves, a long black skirt attached to a little black apron. He'd had Margaret take Ness into the back room so that she could change into it, and Ness had done what she was told. Margaret, seeing Ness all done up, clutched her hand to her heart and told Ness to wait there. Ness had to press her ear to the wall to hear what Margaret said. "She ain't fit for the house," Margaret told Tom Allen. "Well, let me see her, Margaret. I'm sure I can decide for myself whether or not somebody's fit to work in my own house now, can't I?" "Yes, sir," Margaret said. "I reckon you is, but it ain't something you gonna want to see is what I'm saying." Tom Allen laughed. His wife, Susan, came into the room and asked what all the fuss was about. "Why, Margaret's got our new nigger locked up in the back. and won't let us see her. Stop this nonsense now and go fetch her here. If Susan was like any of the other master's wives, she must have known that her husband's bringing a new slave into the house meant she had better pay attention. In this and every other southern county, men's eyes and other body parts had been known to wander. Yes, Margaret, bring the girl so we can see. Don't be silly about it. Margaret shrugged her shoulders and went back to the room, and Ness pulled her ear from the wall. Well, you best come out, was all Margaret said. And so Ness did. She walked out to her audience of two, her shoulders bared as well as the bottom halves of her calves, and when Susan Stockham saw her, she fainted outright. It was all Tom Allen could do to catch his wife while shouting at Margaret to go change Ness at once. Margaret rushed her into the back room and left in search of field clothes, and Ness stood in the center of that room, running her hands along her body, reveling in her ugly nakedness. She knew it was the intricate scars on her bare shoulders that had alarmed them all. But the scars weren't just there. No, her scarred skin was like another body in and of itself, shaped like a man hugging her from behind with his arms hanging around her neck. They went up from her breasts, rounded the hills of her shoulders, and traveled the full, proud length of her back. They licked the top of her buttocks before trailing away into nothing. Ness's skin was no longer skin, really, more like the ghost of her past made seeable, physical. She didn't mind the reminder. Margaret came back in the room with a headscarf, a brown top that covered the shoulders, a red skirt that went all the way to the floor. She watched Ness put them on. And so Ness worked in the field. It was not new to her. In hell, she'd worked the land too. In hell, the sun scorched cotton so hot it almost burned the palms of your hands to touch it. Holding those small white puffs almost felt like holding fire, but God forbid you let one drop. The devil was always watching. Hell was where she had learned to be a good field hand, and the skill had carried her all the way to Tuscumbia. It was her second month at the Stockham plantation. She lived in one of the women's cabins, but she had made no friends. Everyone was angry at her when they thought that she was the object of Tim Tam's affection. And when they realized that she didn't want to be that object, they treated her as though she were little more than a strong wind, an annoyance that you could still push through. In the mornings, Ness prepared her pail to take out to the field with her, cornmeal cakes, a bit of salt pork, and, if she was lucky, some greens. In hell, she had learned to eat standing up, picking cotton with her right hand, shoveling food in with her left. It wasn't something she was required to do here at Tom Allen's, work while eating, but she didn't know any other way. Looked like she thinks she better than us, one woman called, just loudly enough so Ness could hear. Tom Allen sure won't think so, another said. Nuh-uh, Tom Allen ain't paid her no mind since she got kicked out the big house, the first one said. Ness had learned how to tune the voices out. She tried to remember the twee that Essie used to speak to her, tried to still her mind until all that was left was the thin, stern line of her mother's lips, lips that used to usher out words of love in a tongue that Ness could no longer quite grasp. Phrases and words would come to her, mismatched or lopsided, wrong. She worked all day like this, listening to the sounds of the South, the insistent buzz of mosquitoes, the screech of cicadas, the hum of slave gossip. At night, she would return to her quarters, beat out her palette until dust billowed from it, wrapping around her like a hug. She would set it back down again and wait for a sleep that rarely came, trying her best to still the harrowing images that danced behind her closed eyelids. It was on a night like this, just when she had snapped her palette into the air, that the pounding started. Fists beating against the door of the women's cabin in a steady, urgent rhythm. "Please," a voice called. "Please help us." A woman named Mavis opened the door. Tim Tam stood there, cradling his daughter Pinky in his arms. He pushed into the room, his voice choked, though there were no tears in his eyes. "I think she got what her mama had," he said. The women cleared a spot for the girl, and Tim Tam set her down before he started to pace. "Oh Lord, oh Lord, oh Lord," he cried. "You best go fetch the doctor," Ruthie said. "Doctor ain't helped last time," Tim Tam said. Ness stood behind a row of women, their shoulders squared as if headed into battle. She pushed her way through to the center to catch a glimpse of the child. Pinky was small and sharp-edged, as though her body were built from sticks with no bend to them. Her hair was tied up in two big puffs. The whole time the women were watching her, she made no noise save for a quick intake of breath. "Ain't nothing wrong with her," Ness said. Suddenly, Tim Tam stopped his pacing as everyone turned to stare at Ness. "You ain't been round here long," Tim Tam said. "Pinky ain't spoke a word since her mama died, and now she can't stop with these hiccups." "Ain't nothing but hiccups," Ness said. "Those ain't killed anyone yet, as far as I know." She looked around at all the women shaking their heads at her disapprovingly, but she couldn't tell what she'd done wrong. Tim Tam pulled her aside. "These women ain't told you," he whispered, and Ness shook her head. The women so rarely spoke to her, and she had finally gotten good at tuning out their gossip. Tim Tam cleared his throat and hung his head a little lower. "See, we know ain't nothing wrong with her but the hiccups, but we've been trying to get her to speak, so." His voice trailed off as Ness began to understand that the whole thing had been nothing more than a plot to trick little Pinky into utterance. Ness pulled away from Tim Tam and looked at the small congregation of women carefully, from one to the next, and then the next. She made her way to the center of the room, where Pinky lay on the pallet, her eyes staring up at the ceiling. The girl turned her eyes toward Ness and hiccuped once more. Ness addressed the room. "Lord, I don't know what kind of foolishness I done walked into at this here plantation, but y'all need to leave this girl alone. Maybe she don't want to speak because she know just how crazy it make you. Or maybe she ain't got nothing to say yet. But I reckon she ain't gonna start talking tonight just because y'all making like you actors in a traveling show." The women wrung their hands and shifted their feet, and Tim Tam's head sunk a little lower. Ness walked back to the pallet, finished beating the dust out, and lay down. Tim Tam walked over to Pinky. "Well, let's go," he said, reaching for the girl, but she pulled away. "I said, let's go," he repeated, shame coloring his voice gray, but the girl snatched herself away again. She went over to where Ness lay, her eyes shut tightly as she begged sleep to come quick. Pinky's hand brushed Ness's shoulder, and she opened her eyes to see the girl staring at her, round moon eyes, imploring. And because Ness understood loss, and because she understood motherlessness and wanting and even silence, she reached for the girl's hand and pulled her down onto the bed. "You go on ahead," she said to Tim Tam, Pinky's head already nestled between the soft cushions of her breasts. "I got her tonight." From that day forward, Pinky could not be separated from Ness. She had even moved from the other women's cabin into Ness's. She slept with Ness, ate with Ness, took walks with Ness, and cooked with Ness. Still, she didn't speak, and Ness never asked her to, knowing full well that Pinky would speak when she had something to say, laugh when something was truly funny. For her part, Ness, who had not known how much she missed company, took comfort in the girl's quiet presence. Pinky was the water girl. On any given day, she would make as many as 40 trips to the small creek on the edge of the Stockham plantation. She carried a plank of wood across her back, arms folded over it from behind so that she looked like a man holding a cross. And on each end of the plank hung two silver pails. Once she had reached the creek, Pinky would fill those pails, then bring them back to the main house, and then empty them into the large water buckets that lived on the Stockham porch. She would fill the basins in the house so that the Stockham children would have fresh water for their afternoon baths. She would water the flowers that sat on Susan Stockham's dressing table. From there, she went to the kitchen to give two pailfuls to Margaret for the day's cooking. She walked the same worn path every day, down to the creek, back up to the house. By the end of the day, her arms would throb so hard, Ness could feel her heart beat in them when the girl crawled into bed with Ness at night and the woman hugged her close. The hiccups had not stopped, continuing since the day Tim Tam had brought her into Ness's cabin, hoping to scare the child into speaking. Everyone pitched in with a remedy. Stand the girl upside down. Tell her hold her breath and swallow. Cross two straws on top her head. The last remedy, put forth by a woman named Harriet, was the one that seemed to work. Pinky made 34 trips to the creek without a single hiccup. Ness was on the porch getting her fill of water on Pinky's 35th trip back. The two red-headed Stockham children were out and about that day. The boy named Tom Jr. and the girl, Mary. They were running up the stairs just as Pinky rounded the corner and Tom Jr. knocked the plank so that one of the pails went flying into the air, water raining down on everyone on the porch. Mary started to cry. "My dress is all wet," she said. Margaret, who had just finished ladling out water for one of the other slaves, set the ladle down. "Hush now, Miss Mary." Tom Jr., who had never been much for gallantry, decided to try it just then for his sister's sake. "Well, apologize to Mary," he said to Pinky. The two were the same age, though Pinky was about a foot taller. Pinky opened her mouth, but no words came out. "She's sorry," Ness said quickly. "I wasn't talking to you," Tom Jr. said. Mary had stopped crying and was staring at Pinky intently. "Tom, you know she don't talk," Mary said. "It's all right, Pinky." "She'll talk if I tell her to talk," Tom Jr. said, shoving his sister. "Apologize to Mary," he repeated. The sun was high and hot that day. Indeed, Ness could see that the two wet drops on Mary's dress had already dried. Pinky, eyes welling with tears, opened her mouth again and a wave of hiccups came out, frantic and loud. Tom Jr. shook his head. He went into the house while everyone watched and returned with the Stockham cane. It was twice his length, made of a dull birch wood. It wasn't thick, but it was so heavy that Tom Jr. could hardly hold it in both of his hands, let alone the one it would take to snap it back. "Speak, nigger," Tom Jr. said. And Margaret, who had long since stopped her ladling, ran into the house crying, "Ooh, Tom Jr., I'm gonna find your daddy." Pinky was sobbing and hiccuping all at once, the hiccups blocking whatever speech she might have given. Tom Jr. lifted the cane in his right hand with great effort and tried to snap it over his shoulder, but Ness, who was standing behind him, caught the tip of it in her hand. It tore through her palms as she tugged so hard that Tom Jr. fell to the ground. She dragged him half an inch. Tom Allen appeared on the porch with Margaret, who was breathless and clutching her chest. "What's this?" he asked. Tom Jr. started to cry. "She was gonna hit me, Daddy," he said. Margaret tried to speak up. "Massa Tom, you lie, you was..." Tom Allen raised his hand to stop Margaret's speech and looked at Ness. Maybe he remembered the scars on her shoulders, remembered how they kept his wife laid up in bed for the rest of that day and put him off his dinner for a week. Maybe he wondered what a nigger had to do to earn stripes like that, what trouble a nigger like that must be capable of. And there his son was on the ground with dirt on his shorts and the mute child, Pinky, crying. Ness was sure that he could see clear as day what had happened, but it was the memory of her scars that made him doubt. A nigger with scars like that, and his son on the ground. There wasn't anything else he could do. "I'll deal with you soon enough," he said to Ness, and everyone wondered what would happen. That evening, Ness returned to the women's quarters. She crawled into her bed and closed her eyes, waiting for the images that played every night behind her lids to still to darkness. Beside her, Pinky began to hiccup. "Oh Lord, here she go. Ain't we had enough trouble for one day?" one of the women said. "Can't get no kind of rest when this girl start to hiccup." Ashamed, Pinky slapped a hand to her mouth as though with it she could erect a wall to block the sound's escape. "Don't pay them no mind," Ness whispered. "Thinking about it only gonna make it worse." She didn't know if she was speaking to Pinky or to herself. Pinky squeezed her eyes tight as a series of hiccups exploded from her lips. "Leave her be," Ness said to the chorus of groans, and they listened. The events of the day had planted a little dual seed of respect and pity for Ness that they watered with deference of their own. They didn't know what Tom Allen would do. In the night, once they had all finally reached sleep, Pinky rolled over and snuggled into the soft skin of Ness's gut. Ness allowed herself to hold the girl, and she allowed herself to drift off into memory. She is back in hell. She is married to a man they call Sam, but who comes straight from the continent and speaks no English. The master of hell, the devil himself, with red leather skin and a shock of gray hair, prefers his slaves married for reasons of insurance. And because Ness is new to hell, and because no one has claimed her, she is given to calm the new slave, Sam. At first, they do not speak to each other. Ness doesn't understand his strange tongue, and she is in awe of him, for he is the most beautiful man she has ever seen, with skin so dark and creamy that looking at it could very well be the same thing as tasting it. His is the large, muscular body of the African beast, and he refuses to be caged, even with Ness as his welcoming gift. Ness knows that the devil must have paid a great deal of money for him, and therefore expects hard work. But nothing anyone does seems to tame him. On his first day, he fights with another slave, spits on the overseer, and is stood on a platform and whipped in front of everyone until the blood on the ground is high enough to bathe a baby. Sam refuses to learn English. Each night, in retribution for his still black tongue, the devil sends him back to their marriage bed with lashes that are reopened as soon as they heal. One night, enraged, Sam destroys the slave quarters. their room is savaged from wall to wall, and when the devil hears of the destruction, he comes to serve punishment. I did it, Ness says. She has spent the night hidden in the left corner of the room, watching this man she's been told is her husband become the animal he's been told that he is. The devil shows no mercy, even though he knows she is lying, even though Sam tries time and again to accept the blame. She is beaten until the whip snaps off her back like pulled taffy, and then she is kicked to the ground. When he leaves, Sam is crying, and Ness is barely conscious. Sam's words come out in a thick and feverish prayer, and Ness can't understand what he's saying. He picks her up gingerly and places her on their pallet. He leaves the house in search of the herbal doctor 5 miles away, who comes back with the roots and leaves and salves that are smeared into Ness's back as she slips in and out of consciousness. It is the first night that Sam sleeps in the cot with her. And in the morning, when she wakes up to fresh pain and festered sores, she finds him sitting at her feet, staring at her face with his big, tired eyes. "Sorry," he says. They are the first English words he says to her, to anyone. That week, they work side by side in the fields, and the devil, though watchful, does not act against them. In the mornings, they return to their bed, but they sleep on opposite sides of it, never touching. Some nights, they fear that the devil is watching them as they lie, and those are the nights Sam hugs her body to his, waiting for the metronome of fear that keeps her heart's drumbeat moving quickly to slow. His vocabulary has grown to include her name and his. Don't worry and quiet. In a month, he will learn love. In a month, once the wounds on both of their backs have hardened to scars, they finally consummate their marriage. He picks her up so easily, she thinks she must have turned into one of the rag dolls she makes for the children to play with. She has never been with a man before, but she imagines that Sam is not a man. For her, he has become something much closer to God, the Tower of Babel itself. He runs his hands along her scabby back, and she does the same along his. And as they work together, clutching each other, some scars reopen. They are both bleeding now, both bride and bridegroom, in this unholy, holy union. Breath leaves his mouth and enters hers, and they lie together until the roosters crow, until it's time to return to the fields. Ness awoke to Pinky's finger poking her shoulder. "Ness, Ness," she spoke. Ness turned to face the girl, trying to hide her surprise. "Was you having a bad dream?" she asked. "No," Ness said. "It looked like you was having a bad dream," the girl said, disappointed because when she was lucky, Ness told her stories. "It was bad," Ness replied, "but it wasn't no dream." Stop there. They're bringing microphones down, so we have time for questions, if you guys have questions.
So you took your research trip. How long were you there? And once you gathered that initial information, how long did it take for you to really formulate what you wanted to say? And then how long did it take to write?
Okay, So in 2009, when I received that fellowship, I ended up spending about a month in Ghana. And I didn't really know what I was doing or what I wanted to do. And so my research there was kind of haphazard. Because I thought I was writing something different, I kind of had to pivot and start over once I realized what I really wanted to be working on. And so, you know, I visited the Cape Coast Castle. I also visited the Ashanti King's Palace and some other sites that do appear in the book. But that was really kind of it. And I didn't go back. And so after that, when I got back to America, I started working on something, but it was very different from this. Initially, I'd had a much more traditionally structured novel in mind. I thought that I wanted to write something that would take place in the present. So if you've read the book, kind of the last two characters, and then just flash back to 18th century Ghana, so the first two characters. And I worked in this way for probably about 3 years and 100 pages until I realized that I didn't like that and started over. And the reason for this was because as I was working, what I realized that I wanted to do was to kind of be able to look at this long stretch of time. I felt like that aspect of time, of being able to kind of hold 250, 300 years all at once was so much more important to me than what I'd previously considered. And so I knew that the structure needed to change. I needed something that would be able to kind of hold the weight of all of those years. And so I decided to pivot and make something that would allow me to stop in as many generations as possible from 18th century to present day. And so that's how the structure came about. And then from there, I made a family tree that looks a lot like the one at the front of the book, except mine also had dates. And then one thing that was happening politically, historically, in the background during each time period. So for Kojo's chapter, it was the Fugitive Slave Act. For Akuya's chapter, it was the Asantewaa War. And that just helped me kind of figure out where to start with my research. So I wrote chronologically, and I just began each chapter by researching the time period, starting with that, whatever that point was. And then, you know, did just enough research, I think, to make me feel as though I got some sense of what the characters might be dealing with, and then would close the research books, write the chapter. And so that's how I did the first draft. All told, from 2009 to when the book came out, was 7 years. One interesting response that I had been the mic wasn't on. Okay, so she's asking what kind of feedback I've gotten since the book came out, if anything interesting has been said, and how that particular response has shaped what I think my duty as a writer is, right? Okay. So one interesting response that I have been getting that I hadn't anticipated is just people who have come up to me after events and talked about how they've started doing their ancestry DNA kit testing, which was something that I wouldn't have thought of when I was writing the book, but it feels like a very kind of intimate response to have to a book like this, so that's really touched me. In terms of how I feel as though my role as a writer has shifted, I don't know if I have felt that. You know, I think the reasons that I write, the kind of the love of writing, and also the, I guess for me, writing is kind of just a way of creating order. So making sense of the things that I see around me, and that hasn't changed. I don't feel any greater responsibility, I guess, around that, because the pleasure of that and the necessity of that for me is kind of more important, I guess, than what I feel like I could be doing publicly. I hope that in the future, and you know, from now on, I will kind of just continue to pursue things that interest me. I think that's all that I can really hope to do. Yeah, sure.
Do you have any major influences books you read that maybe sent you into this kind of path, or what made you want to become a writer and a reader?
So the book that kind of made me want to become a writer was Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison. I'd always loved writing, and I'd always been a writer. I'd been writing short stories for most of my life, but that book, I think, was just really powerful, and it was the first time that I started to consider writing as a career, before I'd kind of thought of it as a hobby. And then for influences for this book in particular, 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, not just for the amount of time that that book spans, which is really ambitious and wonderful, but also I think just from a writer's perspective, it feels really playful, which I liked. You know, it felt like the kind of thing where you could see that Garcia Marquez was more concerned with, again, with the kinds of thoughts and ideas that were consuming him, and not as much with, you know, what that meant for when the book left his hands. So I like that. I like that aspect of the book. For me, since I was kind of attempting to write a ambitious, you know, multi-generational thing, that felt like a good model.
First of all, thank you for such a beautiful read. It was a very powerful content, but the way that you delivered the material was so, all I can think of is like televisual. It came alive for me, so thank you.
Yeah.
And so I had two questions. One is that you mentioned that your family is from Ghana, or at least your mother is. And so I was curious if you could speak a little bit about that relationship with, for example, the genealogy that you have at the beginning. And then secondly, I was thinking about a documentary that Henry Louis Gates was in, a pretty famous PBS series, where he says that African Americans really don't have a genealogy. It's really hard to find this material. And so it sounds like you did, though, find some research. And I was just curious if you could speak a little bit about that in terms of the genealogy and the DNA. I mean, I think it's different for different communities and races and ethnicities. So that's kind of interesting, and if that was part of your project, perhaps. And then just really quickly, 12 Years a Slave, when I talk about the cinematic, your book is obviously very different. It looks like you're more interested in women's perspective. 12 Years a Slave was not so much, but there was some. If you could just speak a little bit, if you have time, sorry, a lot of questions, to that film, which I know came later. Thank you.
See if I can get that all. So I was born in Ghana. My family left when I was 2, and we moved first to Ohio. My father was getting his PhD at Ohio State. And then we lived in Illinois, Tennessee, and then Alabama. And we moved to Alabama when I was 9, and that's kind of where I did most of my growing up. And so my sense of Ghana is not very, you know, it's not very strong. I didn't spend all that much time there. We went back once as a whole family when I was 11, and then I didn't go back again until 2009 for that research trip. And I didn't do any kind of genealogical research at all, nothing into my own family's history, nothing into anybody else's family's history. I felt really strongly that because I wanted to write something that was completely fictional, if I started to do that kind of work, it would just end up being a completely different project than the one that I intended to do. And so I just decided to forego that. I will say that for the purposes of the book, I focus on two ethnic groups specifically, the Ashanti and the Fanti. My mother is a Fanti and my father is an Ashanti. So that was helpful in kind of helping me, I guess, figure out some of the kind of cultural things that might have been more difficult if I had focused on different groups. But aside from that, no real research into genealogical stuff. 12 Years a Slave, yeah, that came out, when did that come out? It came out when I was still in graduate school. So I had been working on this novel for a while, but I hadn't quite finished it yet. I had already finished Kodjo's chapter, which is the chapter that deals with the Fugitive Slave Act in my novel, but it was certainly interesting to see the movie and kind of get this other side of what might have occurred after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act. I think it's a very powerful movie, but I think it's also one that that I worried about because the ending is so optimistic and hopeful. You know, he gets to go back to the North, and that was not the case for most people who were kind of entangled in this moment. So, so one of my hopes, I guess, for Homegoing was that that it allow us to kind of see the legacy of slavery so that we didn't kind of compartmentalize things and feel as though history was something that happened and then ended, you know, happened and then had like a neat little ending, because I don't think that that's true. It is Hollywood, but thankfully I'm not in Hollywood.
So on that same topic, the concept or the theme of a family curse or family curse wins through all the chapters. Hmm. How did your understanding of that inform the book, and how did it change as you wrote?
It was really formative. I knew once I figured out what I wanted to do, the first kind of image that came to me was one of somebody setting a really great big fire and escaping into it. And so on the very first page, Kobe, the father of Afia, talks about this fire destroying his yam crop. And he says that he's lost 7 yams, and he thinks of this loss as a kind of generational curse. So we can assume that this curse is going to affect 7 generations, and there are 7 generations in the book. I think because I was writing something that was going to span such a long time period, something that I really kind of struggled to figure out and deal with in the beginning was how to have a kind of consistent voice and how to allow the chapters to cohere in a satisfying way. And so for the first question of having something that sounded like one voice, what I decided to do, especially for those earlier chapters, was to play on fables and folktales. And so the curse was a way to kind of create something that needed a more oracular voice. So I wanted this sense of us all sitting around a campfire being told a story. And I think we get that from a lot of different fables. And so Afia's chapter especially is very kind of classically fairy tale. You know, there's an evil stepmother, there's a beautiful daughter, there's a curse. And that kind of allowed me, I think, to set up this really pulled back voice. As the chapters continue, we get closer and closer. So by the time we get to Marcus and Marjorie, we're in a very close third person. But in the beginning, that curse was a way to kind of think of structure, think of voice. And then the second aspect of figuring out how to make things cohere was working around the idea of fire and water. So because I'd opened with this curse that was attached to fire, and because I was working on a lineage, I hoped to have every character who is a descendant of Afia be in some way a descendant of this fire. And so you have characters who are touched by fire in some way, they're burned by it, they're enamored with it, whatever the case may be. And then on Essie's side, because she is sent through the Middle Passage onto America, there's this similar relationship with water. And that was just kind of a kind of shorthand, I guess, trick for me to figure out a way to allow myself to think of these first two characters and think of a way to kind of bring them throughout the novel. So when you see a character like Yao, who's got that scar on his face from the fire, you remember his mother, who was visited by this vision of a fire woman. And when you see her, you remember this fire from the first chapter. So that was kind of what was going on with the fire and the water and the curses.
about the two stone pendants that you had, one on each side of the sisters' lines? Was that also something of the device where they pop up from time to time and got kind of tantalizingly close but never joined together?
Yeah, that the stone wasn't in the first draft, actually. I had finished an entire draft of the novel, and when I shared it with my with one of my readers, who was also my thesis advisor at Iowa, she said, you know, it would be nice to kind of be able to follow a physical object as we move through the line. And I really liked that idea, again, just in thinking of ways to allow the book to cohere. Since I knew that I was working in a structure that doesn't kind of offer us the typical pleasures that you get from reading a book that follows fewer characters and has a shorter time period. The stone was kind of a way to again bring everybody together and have little reminders. And I had to play with it. Like the first time I did it, it was in every single chapter, and it was too much. And then third draft, it got a little better. Fourth draft, it got a little better. But yeah. Okay. Thank you.